Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Thank you for coming to the lecture. I'm George Part. I'm one of the dermatologists working here at Roswell Park, and I came to talk to you today about cutaneous malignancies. I'll talk about some clinical aspects, also some research aspects. Feel free to stop me essentially at any time and ask questions. Obviously, at the end, also feel free to ask questions. There's quite a bit that we'll be covering today, and there are going to be a couple of slides that I'll be going through fairly fast. In order to make studying a lot easier for you, I put exclamation marks on the slides, which I view sort of as the most important slides from which the questions, you know, you should be expecting. This way, I think, also studying for the test is going to be a lot easier. So one more thing also before we start, that I'm using a couple of images that are borrowed from these sources, and these are actually also awesome sources if you want to look up dermatological images for any project that you might be doing. The learning objectives are, first I'll do a short introduction to the skin. I'll talk about epidermal carcinogenesis. We'll review common cutaneous malignancies, and the epidemiology and also the classification of these. I'll also have quite a few images. Images are usually pretty gruesome. It's really hard to take nice-looking photos of skin cancer, so if anyone is easily sick to their stomach, you know, you may occasionally want to look down and not look at the images. And I'll also talk about treatment of common cutaneous malignancies. One thing, you guys may have received a paper on the immunotherapy of melanoma. I'm not going to go at depth into it because really immunotherapy is all over. You probably heard multiple presentations already on it ad nauseam at this point. So I'll just briefly touch on it and sort of how it affects skin cancer treatment. So first and foremost, the skin is our largest organ. This is something that in dermatology we usually like to remind people of. The function is mostly maintaining internal homeostasis in light of sort of all the external stimuli. So it's really a barrier. It also has some endocrinological functions and obviously secretory functions and excretory functions as well. Because of its role as an acute barrier, the deficiency of the skin can really lead to acute demise of a person. If you lose the body surface areas, transepidermal water loss prevention capability, then you will allow a person to dehydrate within a matter of hours. So that's very, very important to remember. The structure of the skin is depicted here. Mostly we'll talk about the epidermis because when it comes to carcinogenesis, really that's the most that's the layer where you'll see most of the skin cancer arise from. Underneath the epidermis there's the dermis, and underneath there's a subcutaneous layer made up of subcutaneous fat. The epidermis is made up of mostly keratinocytes. Obviously, there are also melanocytes, which many of you heard of, and we'll talk a tiny bit longer about later on when we talk about melanoma. Langerhans cells, Merkel cells, and transient cells, leukocytes are also present, but the bulk of the epidermis is made up of keratinocytes. And the keratinocyte differentiation is really the basis of the production of the epidermal barrier. It's a process during which keratinocytes initially in the basal layer kind of proliferate. After proliferation, they'll go through the differentiation process. They'll accumulate lipids, which they'll quickly deposit and then they transform into corneocytes, into striated corneum. We'll talk a tiny bit more about that. But again, to remember that keratinocyte differentiation is the process that creates the epidermal barrier. Without appropriate differentiation, there's no epidermal barrier. And because of this differentiation process and the constant regeneration of the epidermis, which takes approximately 28 days from the basal layer for a cell to go up all the way to the top of the striatum corneum and completely shed off, because of the speed of this proliferation and differentiation process, obviously the epidermis is prone to accumulating mutations. During the differentiation process, the cells, as I mentioned, go through a complete restructuring of their internal complete production capability of lipids and proteins, and there's a complete shift in the proteins that are produced and also of the lipids that are generated. In the stratum basale, you'll have the proliferating cells and the transient amplifying cells that are committed already to differentiation but are still proliferating. These are mostly cubital and columnar cells. And also, this area is one of the area for the epidermal stem cells, which are capable of renewing the whole of the epidermis. These epidermal stem cells give rise to the epidermal proliferation units, which are areas of the epidermis which are derived from a single stem cell, which in case, once when you do an experiment where you label some of the stem cells with beta-gal, you actually can visualize these epidermal proliferation units in mouse skin. I mentioned that some of the stem cells reside in the stratum basale, in the basal layer. Some of the stem cells, however, also reside in the hair bulge. And so these are the two areas of the sort of epidermal stem cell compartments. This is really important because if you have epidermal damage and you get rid of the complete epidermis, if the hair bulge remains, you can still have very fast recapitulation of the whole epidermis because you still have stem cells that survive. In case you have deeper damage to the skin, for example, during a deeper level burn, then you'll have much harder time sort of refilling the gap and healing the area because you'll have to have stem cells and you'll have to have keratinocytes growing from all the surrounding areas. The hair follicle is not going to be able to help you sort of recapitulate the epidermis. The layer above the stratum basale is the spinous layer where the cells start to differentiate and start to sort of accumulate lipids and start to produce also some of the proteins that are required for the generation of later the stratum corneum. Then the cells transition into the stratum granulosum, where the first granules, which we'll briefly touch on during the coming slides, sort of are visible with electron microscopy, which accumulate all the proteins and also the lipids, although those are not visible, those granules, and all the lipids that are required for the epidermal barrier. These granules are the keratohyaline granules and the lamellar granules. The keratohyaline granules are the ones that are visible, and these give the name to the stratum granulosum, whereas the lamellar granules are also very important, but these are invisible with normal H&E and with light microscopy. They become visible on electron microscopy. The lamellar granules mostly contain lipids, although they also contain some proteins that are required for processing of the lipids and then later on shedding of the epidermis. The keratohyaline granules mostly contain structural lipids. This is a figure that shows you sort of the composition of the lipids in various different layers of the epidermis, and the important thing to remember again is that there's a complete reshuffling of the lipidome of the cells during the differentiation process, and this is required because you have to create the stratum corneum lipids during keratinocyte differentiation. And these need to be actually stored in the lamellar granules because these lipids are actually toxic to the cells. If they are not structured appropriately, they would lead to demise of the cells and you wouldn't have proper differentiation. The major lipid classes in the barrier, again, it's in the stratum corneum, are cholesterol, free fatty acids, and ceramides. And all of these are important for adequate function of the epidermal barrier. And this is, again, once you sort of reach the top of the stratum granulosum, then the cells undergo a terminal, they complete sort of the terminal differentiation process. They lose their nuclei, and they'll deposit the lipids in between the so-called corneified envelopes, which are the dead sort of remnants of the keratinocytes. So these are, again, the two major components of the stratum corneum: the lipid lamellae, which are the deposited lipids, and the corneocytes. The corneocytes, again, are nuclei-less, and these are composed of the proteins, mostly derived from the keratohyaline granules, whereas the lipid lamellae are, again, mostly derived from the lamellar bodies, which are the lipid-containing granules in the stratum granulosum. All of this differentiation process is needed to generate sort of normal-looking skin. And during almost any pathologic process, you'll see some kind of alteration of the differentiation process, and that's going to lead to the altered look of the epidermis, like in case of the separate keratosis or these warts or psoriasis or the chronic lichenified dermatitis that's caused by rubbing of the skin that you see up in the far corner. Next, we'll talk about skin cancer. And again, first we'll talk about non-skin cancer. These are derived from keratinocytes. And then we'll talk most at the end mostly about melanoma, which are cancers of melanocytes and malignancies of melanocytes. Non-melanoma skin cancers are cancers that you may not have heard that much about. These include basal cell and squamous cell carcinomas. And although you don't never see them in statistics, and I'll have a figure on this later on, these are actually still the most common human malignancies. They account for approximately 5.4 million cases of cancer just in the U.S. Annually in approximately 3.3 million people. I say approximately because, unfortunately, these are not reportable, so we don't have absolutely clear numbers. And most of the non-melanoma skin cancers are basal cell carcinomas, whereas a smaller subset, approximately a fifth, are squamous cell carcinomas. There has been a huge rise in incidence in non-melanoma skin cancers in the last two decades in the United States. And again, as I mentioned, cancer statistics do not report non-melanoma skin cancers, but it's not because they are rare. It's actually because they are so common that they are sort of eliminated in order to not overshadow other cancer types. And one of the other reasons is because most of the times the outcome is better in skin cancer, so people kind of regard them as, oh, just a skin cancer, although they still lead to a substantial amount of human morbidity and mortality. When it comes to non-melanoma skin cancers, the total mortality is approximately 3 to 10,000. Again, it's an estimate because we don't have, unfortunately, clear numbers. And they are also very frequently multiple in people. So one person who's diagnosed with one is much more likely to be diagnosed with another one. And they are also a substantial cost for the healthcare system. When it comes to the risk factors, the most important risk factors are going to be UV exposure. For squamous cell carcinoma, it is mostly cumulative and occupational UV exposure. For basal, it's sort of so cumulative plays a role, but intermittent high sun exposure is very important also. Ionizing radiation is also a risk for both of them. And chemicals such as arsenic is also important. And HPV, obviously, in squamous cell carcinoma, although mostly in the anogenital region, in the sort of perioral region and on the hands. And cigarette smoking in squamous cell carcinoma is also important. There are also a couple of genetic syndromes that are affiliated with increased risk of non-melanoma skin cancer. They are picked up there. I'm not going to go through all of them to save time. And the other thing that's important to remember that when it comes to squamous cell carcinoma, non-human wounds, so anything that leads to sort of constant proliferation, yet increased reactive oxygen species and constant damage is also going to be a risk factor, such as those conditions up there. And immunosuppression is a very important risk factor too, which we'll briefly discuss later on a couple of slides. But it's important to remember that actually from the major malignancies, really squamous cell carcinoma rates, cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma rates are the ones that rise most in people who have had organ transplantation. Up to 65 to 250-fold increase in squamous cell carcinoma risk is observed. Other risk factors, obviously, there are, besides genetic syndromes, there are also endogenous risk factors when it comes to the pigmentary phenotype. People who have fair skin, who always burn and never tan, who have more freckling and red hair, are much more prone to develop all of these skin cancers, and also melanoma. As I briefly already mentioned, UV radiation is the most important environmental risk factor. So I'll briefly talk about UV radiation, first introducing it to you, then cellular effects, then skin changes in general. There, I'll mostly focus on photocarcinogenesis. I'll only kind of on a list touch additional effects of UV radiation. So first the introduction. So UV radiation is obviously shorter wavelength light with higher energy per photon than visible light. UVA is going to be the 315 to 400 nanometer. UVB is 290 to 315. And occasionally different studies may report somewhat different boundaries. Really, it's not as important. The important thing to remember is that really UVC really sort of overlaps very well with the DNA's absorption spectrum. UVB is very close by, so obviously UVB is going to be a lot more likely to cause direct DNA damage, whereas UVA is much less prone to causing direct DNA damage, but it can induce reactive oxygen species, and I'll repeat this later on also. When it comes to the effect of UV and any other radiation, obviously it's important to know sort of what happens with the light in the skin. Anything that's reflected or scattered is not going to cause a problem. Anything that's transmitted is not going to create an issue, really. It's absorbed UV radiation that matters. And biology obviously try to help us with that and try to sort of put in decoys for UV light. For example, if there's increased UV exposure, the skin thickens. There's going to be actually more reflection, more scattering. There's also going to be parakeratosis potentially that we can see, which means that the nuclei will remain in the stratum corneum cells, creating also more reflection and resulting in less absorption in the basal layer. And also thickening of the epidermis is very important, because one more thing that you need to sort of recognize from the prior slides that we discussed, that the layer that's more prone to damage is the stratum basalis. So if you cause damage to stratum granulosum cells or even stratum spinosum cells that have already committed to terminal differentiation, there's really no way that those will ever turn into cancer. You need to get the UV energy sort of down to the stratum basale, and it needs to be absorbed by essentially stem cells there in order for it to be able to cause long-term damage and the potential risk of cancer formation. When it comes to sort of the solar spectrum, it's important to note that the solar spectrum does contain a significant amount of UVC, but all the UVC is absorbed by the atmosphere, and also the solar spectrum will contain a lot more UVB than what's transmitted by the atmosphere. And really, when it comes to the terrestrial UV that hits our skin, approximately, and it's sort of really an approximate number, approximately 5% of it is going to be UVB. And when it comes to the UV, and I'm just talking about the UV radiation, and approximately 95% of it is going to be UVA, but it varies actually during the day. It varies based on latitude, it varies based on seasonality, based on cloud cover, and a bunch of other factors. UV light is not only UV light from the sun that we encounter. Also, there are artificial UV sources that are important to remember, such as germicidal lamps, welding arcs. And when it comes to sort of working in a lab, I just want to remind everyone that really UVC and the germicidal light is very, very capable of causing mutations in the skin. The good thing is that it's absorbed very well by plastics and absorbed by glass, absorbed actually even by oxygen. So if it's transmitted through a thicker layer of for example, the atmosphere, it doesn't get to our skin. But if you're sitting in a hood and you have the germicidal lamp up, you can have really bad burns. So be very careful with that. One other thing that a lot of people usually ask about is the nail curing light. That's actually UVA, and I'll briefly talk about that later. But there are also a couple of additional artificial light sources that one needs to remember, and also tanning beds. So the thing about tanning beds is, obviously tanning beds emit mostly in the UVA spectrum, very little UVB, although it really depends on what tubes they use. There are some tubes that will have slightly higher UVB content. Nevertheless, we do know that UVA is also mutagenic. And really, at this point, we advise everyone, especially with history of skin cancer, against using tanning beds. And in particular, younger people, we try to advise against using tanning beds, because there's some evidence that the younger someone is, the more likely any damage will sort of result in, for example, melanoma formation. And again, as I mentioned, when it comes to the nail curing lamps, this is mostly UVA, and the amount of UV is relatively small, so at this point we believe that the chance of this causing sort of cancer formation down the line is very, very low. That said, obviously, we'll know for sure 30, 40 years down the line, when these have been around for such a long time that you can do epidemiologic studies to prove that really our initial suspicion was correct, that these are not very likely to cause cancer. The other thing that we need to discuss is, as I said, that really absorption is what matters. And really what matters is what gets to different layers of the epidermis. And It's important to know that UVB really is absorbed fairly fast, and therefore it does get to the stratum basale, but it's really absorbed and doesn't really get very deep into the dermis and barely reaches sort of the stratum basale. UVA, however, goes much deeper, and therefore it has a lot more dermal effect. And this is something that I usually highlight for people, especially who are very hard at creating tanning bed use. It's very important to remember that UVA is actually, that comes also mostly from tanning beds, is the light that you want to use if you want beautiful even wrinkling of your skin long term. So really it is the light that will damage your dermis and will cause a lot of chronic UV damage that results in wrinkle formation and sort of the aesthetic aspect of long-term photo damage. So oftentimes younger people don't really listen when we tell them that tanning beds cause potentially skin cancer down the line, but when we mention how likely they are to actually increase wrinkling and skin aging, people are a lot more prone to listen. When it comes to sort of what happens in the skin, it's important again to remember that UVB is the portion of the UV spectrum that hits our skin on the terrestrial surface that's more prone and most prone to cause direct DNA damage. And really it aligns very well with the erythema action spectrum. So the portion of the light that is capable of causing redness in the skin is also the portion of the light that's capable of causing DNA damage. However, when it comes to the photocarcinogenic spectrum, the two don't completely align. So there's actually a small peak in the photocarcinogenic action spectrum that's in the UVA, and actually the sort of the longer wavelength UVA region of the spectrum, as opposed to sort of what one would think of what would be the case when you look at the DNA damage action spectrum. And this is still kind of a conundrum, and it's not fully understood as to why it is. And there are a couple of groups addressing that. Some of the things that we're doing may actually help also address this. When it comes to cellular effects, there are multiple targets in the skin. But out of all these targets, really most of the targets can be considered kind of decoys and will help absorb UV light and prevent DNA and RNA damage. Although one thing to remember is that sometimes when some of these other biomolecules absorb UV light, they may get into an excited state and they may release that energy later on and may cause secondary DNA damage. But really still for us, the most important thing is the light that gets absorbed by DNA. Because that's what's capable of causing long-term mutations. And when it comes to DNA, obviously different portions of DNA are differently likely to absorb UV light and undergo mutations induced by UV light. Pyrimidine dimers are most prone to absorb UV energy, and we're most likely to see cyclobutadiene pyrimidine dimers after UV exposure. As a sort of a DNA lesion and DNA change. The second most frequently seen photo product, as we call that, is the 6-4 pyrimidone, so 6-4 photo product as we abbreviate it. And these, however, when it comes to mutagenic potential, are much less prone to inducing mutations because they are much more likely and much faster repaired than the cyclobutadiene pyrimidine dimers. And as I mentioned before, UV also is capable of inducing oxidative stress, especially UVA. The reactive oxygen species generated by UVA can also cause indirect DNA damage, which will mostly induce 8-oxyG formation. But it can also induce, obviously, strand breaks and all the rest. And for a long time, actually, UVA was kind of regarded as a portion of the UV light that's capable of causing some mutations, but still much less likely to cause cancer. But recently, we learned that actually UVA is also capable of causing CPDs by actually inducing an activated state of melanin. And after inducing the activated state of melanin, melanin is capable of releasing the energy after it goes into the nucleus, and it can create CPDs. And this has been proven by the lab of Doug Rush 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, at Yale in a mouse model. Then there's DNA change, obviously. there's going to be a mechanism that tries to avoid long-term mutations. The mechanism when it comes to CPDs is called nucleotide excision repair. I highlighted it not because I want you guys to memorize the whole process, just really remember the name and the function of it, and remember that nucleotide excision repair is really the only repair that's capable of removing CPDs in the human genome. And actually, this is something that I'll mention on the sideline. This is really interesting because when it comes to sort of lower level organisms, there are actually enzymes capable of removing CPDs called photolyases, and for some reason evolutionarily we lost them, and therefore really we need a much more complicated process than an enzyme that's actually activated by blue light and is capable of enzymatically removing CPDs, which is something that we don't fully understand at this point why it happened evolutionarily and what's the evolutionary advantage of losing photolyase. So for really, humans, obviously, it's only nucleotide excision repair. When it comes to nucleotide excision repair, obviously, if something can be broken, there are going to be cases when it is broken. Scleroderma pigmentosum is the group of diseases that we see in people who have nucleotide excision repair deficiency, and I'm not going to go through the various different XB subvariants, but it's important to remember that, obviously, when you have decreased repair of CPDs, then you'll see greatly increased photodamage much earlier in life. And people will show much larger number of freckles and solar lentigines and much earlier development of also skin cancers. You see the numbers up there. Really, it's not uncommon for people with XB to develop squamous cell carcinoma before reaching their teens. So if there's a good repair process, what is the problem with UV? Well, obviously repair is error-prone, so although there's a repair process, it won't always be there to repair all the photo lesions that are formed. And because of that, some of the damage will eventually result in the generation of mutations. And this is something that I touched on. Mutations, obviously, and DNA damage. So one of the things to also remember that once a cell suffers significant DNA damage, obviously there are sensory signals that will signal to other parts of the genome that this is too much. We probably can't handle it. And so the options for the cell are going to be sort of sit it out, try to repair, risk potentially having mutations be passed along to progeny, or call it a day and say that we were too damaged, now we're heading out, and let's have other cells replace this cell because there's no way that we'll repair the damage. And really, DNA damage signaling obviously is intended to sort of sense this and make these cell fate decisions, which I'm not going to go through in detail. The important thing why I brought these figures is to remember that p53 is a very important component of UV damage signaling, also as it is important in many other pathological and obviously physiological processes. So when it comes to UV-induced skin changes, I'm skipping a bunch of things because of the lack of time. And we'll mostly focus on photocarcinogenesis. When it comes to vitamin D, just one thing that I think is just as scientists is important for you to remember that there's currently no plausible evidence that vitamin D produced in our skin because of UV exposure is going to be differently effective in the body than vitamin D ingested. So if someone tells you that they are getting a tan because they want to produce more vitamin D, then this is something that they can tell them, and they can quote me or they can go to literature to kind of verify this. But this is something that at this point we all tell our patients. The other thing to remember is that vitamin D production is actually helped by and sort of induced by UVB radiation. So when someone goes and wants to go to a tanning booth in the middle of the winter to have higher vitamin D production, it's complete baloney. It won't happen. Really, that's not the right light to induce vitamin D production, and they shouldn't be doing it. So these are just two things that I think are good to remember as scientists. So photocarcinogenesis. new resignature mutations. So obviously, as different parts of the genome and sort of different nucleotide structures are more likely to form DNA lesions, the mutations will also take place in different areas and will have sort of a UV signature to them as it's depicted up there. And this is important because this can actually be used to identify cancers that were caused by UV light, because they'll have a lot more of these UV signature mutations in driver genes. And as I briefly talked about it, obviously we need unrepaired damage to cause mutations in important tumor suppressor or oncogenes to lead to carcinogenesis. When it comes to sort of damage to the skin, one histological aspect of UV damage I want to discuss is sunburst cell generation. So when you shine UV light on the skin, again, damage is going to take place in the nuclei of the cells. And if the cells decide that they'll go down the route of apoptosis and they'll essentially hasten the terminal differentiation and will shift it a tiny bit, then they'll produce sunburn cells. And this is really an easy way to evaluate the apoptotic process after UV. And this is something that if you read about sort of almost any study that they do with UV and UV carcinogenesis, you may encounter that they'll be counting sunburn cells in the epidermis to look at the effect of UV on apoptosis of keratinocytes. One thing to remember, though, is that sunburn cell number increase doesn't necessarily correlate with mutagenesis and what's being passed along, because as I told you, sunburn cells are the cells that are apoptotic and that sort of are going to be lost. In case you don't lose cells, it could be also because you introduce, for example, a mutation in one of the DNA damage sensing pathways that will lead to a decreased apoptosis induction and increased likelihood of the mutations being passed on to progeny. So it could still, lower sunburn cells could still actually lead to an increased number of skin cancer down the line. And this is basically what's up here, but I wanted to talk about it while we were seeing that picture of the sunburn cell. Decision about cell fate is greatly decided actually through mitochondrial pathways. And again, the importance of p53 I've highlighted before and cannot be emphasized enough. And again, there are multiple pathways that will feed into the decision on cell fate, but p53 is crucial. And sunburn cell formation also goes along with erythema. So one thing that we know that the death of the cells and apoptosis of the cells is needed for the redness to be seen in the epidermis. However, if the cells don't go through the terminal differentiation process faster and are not lost, then potentially you have an increased risk of having mutations accumulated in the cells, which will later on lead to cancer formation. But the process is not one step. Obviously, all of you heard of the multi-step carcinogenic process. Really, many of it, or much of it, we learned actually from UV carcinogenesis and in the epidermis. And I do believe that the epidermal model can still serve with examples for other cancer sites with important examples of how early carcinogenesis is driven. I talked about p53 and the importance of p53 in deciding cell fate. That's true. But p53, when it comes to sort of as a marker of photodamage, also is important because p53 is an important tumor suppressor gene because of its importance in deciding cell fate. And also, when p53 is mutated, many of the mutations will actually lead to accumulation of the protein. Because of that, it is a marker that you can see actually fairly easily in the epidermis in areas of chronic UV damage. Also, p53 mutations, because of the importance of p53, are very frequently seen and have been very early on described in photocarcinogenesis and squamous cell carcinomas. And we know that in areas of badly photodamaged skin with significant UV exposure but no visible signs of precancerous or skin cancer formation, there are actually groups of cells that are positive for p53 immunologically. And these have been shown to actually harbor p53 mutations. So there are these early p53 positive cell clones and cell groups in the epidermis in chronic UV exposed areas that actually account for, in some areas, as much as 4 to 5% of the total surface area of the epidermis. These were later on also shown to be sort of the earliest hallmarks of epidermal carcinogenesis. And for a long time, essentially, it was felt that you have UV. UV causes mutations in p53 in some cell groups. Then these cell groups will expand. They'll accumulate a couple of additional mutations, and that's how skin cancer will form. And there's ample evidence that again, p53 mutations are very important. These p53 mutated clones, actually, with additional UV exposure, will continue to grow. And the driving force behind this growth is actually UV-induced apoptosis in the normal cells and not necessarily mutations early on, which is also a sort of a striking finding, that you don't necessarily need, in order to drive extremely early carcinogenesis, you don't necessarily need additional mutations. You can have early mutations in one important gene that, and that's obviously, there are some other things that can take place, and there are some alterations in the genome that may ensue, but still you don't need necessarily additional driver mutations early on to drive clonal growth. Just the sheer fact that additional noxa to the surrounding area is going to cause more damage there, and these cells are less prone to dying because of the decreased ability of the p53 pathway to push them towards apoptosis, is sufficient to drive clonal growth early on. One more interesting thing, that if you actually induce extreme genotoxic trauma, you may eradicate some of the p53 clones. So this is a finding that was published 4 years ago, that on the contrary to what you think, if you have additional UV to an area, really the amount of UV that one gets to an area also matters. In case a p53 clone laid an area of the skin that was where p53 clone formation was driven by chronic UVB exposure, is exposed to very high amount of UVB that causes acute sunburn, as opposed to increased skin cancer formation, you will actually see decreased skin cancer formation early on, because that very high noxa is actually capable of sort of overcoming the mutation, the p53 mutation induced decreased ability of the cells to apoptose, and will still lead to apoptosis of many of the clones, and therefore early on decreased carcinogenesis. So this is, I think, also finding that in many other cancer sites is much harder to mimic, much harder to show, but I'm pretty sure that it is going to be present in almost all, at least epithelial carcinomas. For a long time, p53 again was considered to be the earliest step in this clone formation, although many of us thought that probably p53 clones are not the only potential tumor suppressor mutations that may drive early clonal growth. We had to wait until 3 years ago when this paper was published, where they looked at epidermis removed for blepharocolasis, so blepharoplasty. So essentially, when the upper eyelid is sagging, then people can, then oculoplastic surgeons can do a surgery called blepharoplasty, where you remove the sagging skin, and this results in otherwise normally completely discarded and unused epidermal tissue from a sun-exposed area of the face. And in this study, what they did was they did extremely small punch biopsies down to 1 millimeter in an area, and they eliminated the epidermis, or they selected the epidermis in these areas, and then they subjected it to sequencing of altogether 0.66 megabase in that area of previously sort of arbitrarily selected tumor suppressor and oncogenes that they thought could have an importance in epidermal carcinogenesis. And they found that besides p53, there's a high number of sort of clonal mutation present also in multiple other genes, such as NOTCH1, FET1, NOTCH2, RBM10, and NOTCH3, and a couple of other genes as well. And the other striking thing was, and we're talking about, again, eyelid skin that's not removed for any clinical purpose besides essentially cosmesis, because it was sagging, so there's nothing visible on it. These are perfectly normal-looking eyelid areas. The other striking thing that they found was that actually the clonal burden and the total amount of cells that these clones encompass in one of the patients was a third of the total surface area of the epidermis. In the patient where it was the lowest, it was 18% of the epidermis, still almost a fifth of the epidermis in these people, again, who had no visible sign of sort of sun damage-induced changes in the epidermis, was clonal. So clones are not only present, they are actually present in huge numbers. And so now we believe that really the multitude of these clones is responsible for the earliest stage of photocarcinogenesis, and it's not only going to be obviously P53 clones, but it's going to be NOTCH1, NOTCH2 clones and some of the other genes that will be responsible for the early changes that will enable cells to then first expand, then accumulate additional damage, and potentially also form clinically visible precancerous lesions, and then later on transition into skin cancer. The reason why this is so important, because not all clinical lesions will actually transition from clinically visible precancer, and very frequently, almost 50% of the cases of, for example, squamous cell carcinoma will actually come from clinically completely normal-looking skin areas, where you don't have visible precancers as precursor lesions. So now we finally know sort of what kind of precursors we need to look for and potentially what kind of precursors we can treat. So actually one of the research projects that we're doing is addressing this, and we established, based on these initial findings, a new method for evaluating early epidermal carcinogenesis to evaluate photocarcinogenic burden, which is something that we also want to use to evaluate, and we already are in the first phases of that study, to evaluate the efficacy of field treatment, which I'll briefly talk about. So treatment for very damaged areas of the skin which are damaged by sunlight, but which don't necessarily have precancerous changes or history of skin cancer. So after talking about these sort of pro-precancerous lesions, which are not clinically visible, next we'll talk about the first visible precancerous lesions. These are called actinic keratoses. They are also occasionally called solar keratoses. These are considered precancerous, but there's a very low rate of transition into actual skin cancer. Approximately there's a 1 in 1,000 chance during a year for one of these to turn into squamous cell carcinoma, although really the number needs to be taken with a grain of salt, because if you look at the literature, really the numbers are so varied and all the studies are done so differently that it's very hard to come up with a absolutely true and believable number. That's also one of the reasons why we're working on establishing a much more accurate way of assessing photocarcinogenic damage in the epidermis, because counting precancers is absolutely inaccurate. And I'll show you images to show you why. Many people will have multiple of these precancers when they present, and as I mentioned, a relatively high number of squamous cell carcinomas will start from these precancerous lesions, but it is not a prerequisite to have a precancerous lesion like this for a squamous cell carcinoma to form, and quite a few of them will actually develop without the prior presence of actinic keratosis in the area. The risk factors for formation of actinic keratosis are exactly the same as for squamous cell carcinomas. And the sunscreen and low-fat diet, interestingly, can reduce their formation. There's some evidence that they can help in decreasing the risk for actinic keratosis. And most frequent in these areas, and clinically, classically, these will appear as rough pink, red, fine papules on the skin, which will have this angular scale. And in many people who will show up, they'll show up with kind of a sea of these and multiple of these, especially who come to a tertiary cancer center like us. And this is the problem with counting them, or you really can't count them. You could try to like give a surface area of how much of the surface is involved, but even that's very hard to give, because as you see, what do you count as an actinic keratosis? It's very obvious that that area is also an actinic keratosis, but it's not going to be too rough. Do you count that, or do you only count these areas? It's almost impossible to give a good measure if you're only counting these. Another example of a lot of actinic keratosis on someone's forearm, and also a couple of additional photos of actinic keratoses. These are much thinner areas, but these are still, again, actinic keratoses on someone's forehead. And these are much more subtle actinic keratoses with probably also minimal makeup over them. And this is actinic keratitis, which is essentially the equivalent of actinic keratoses on the lip. When it comes to treatment of actinic keratoses, the most commonly used treatment is going to be destructive treatment. When you only have a couple of areas, especially if they are thicker, this is absolutely reasonable. But when you have a large area affected by actinic keratoses, then really spot treatment is not going to be much and very useful, because as you can easily envision, obviously you could freeze some of these thicker areas here. The adjacent areas that will give rise to the new cells that grow into the area, and obviously also the underlying hair follicles are still going to be damaged. So unless you have a better method of getting rid of the precancer-laden cells, you will not make that much of a difference. You may somewhat reduce the chance of squamous cell carcinoma formation, but patients will be coming back month after month, or maybe only every 6 months, but they'll be having a lot of these precancers treated, and potentially skin cancers also later on that need treatment. So that's the reason why field treatment methods have been developed. These are actually treatments where you don't focus on a single area of precancer, you focus on a whole field of damage, and you treat that whole field of damage with either a chemotherapeutic agent like 5-fluorouracil, or with photodynamic therapy that obviously induces reactive oxygen species and gets rid of precancerous cells that way, or topical immunotherapy with imiquimod, or potentially even an NSAID like diclofenac, or topical immunotherapy with ingetal mabulate, which is a newer agent that we use, or potentially also with chemical pills that occasionally can get rid of them, induce a healing process that will also induce resolution of some of these, sort of that takes us back to sufficient enough NOXA to lead to damage and elimination of some of the early clones, despite the fact that even some of these methods may be viewed as potentially themselves mutagenic. Field treatment works great, it's just very hard to do, and often people will get field treatment extremely late into the disease course. And they'll have substantial redness in the areas. This gentleman actually has a blog on this, and he permitted us to use his photos also in the clinic to show for our patients the sort of efficacy of field treatment and what they can anticipate after field treatment. And he used 5-fluorouracil twice a day for 30 days. Causing obviously a lot of redness, which lasts also a long time after you stop the treatment, but long term actually results in very good healing and very good elimination of precancers. And this is another gentleman who did 5-U treatment, and you'll see sort of again resolution of all these areas. And these white spots are what cryotherapy causes. So he had a lot of cryotherapy previously, and that's really those white spots and the damage to the melanocytes because of liquid nitrogen are what you see there. And when it comes to field treatment, actually often it produces much better cosmetic outcomes. So after talking about precancerous lesions and we talked about treatment of precancers, next let's talk about cutaneous squamous cell carcinomas. Actinic keratoses are important because, again, they can give rise to squamous cell carcinomas, and squamous cell carcinomas are the second most common human malignancies. They are also the second most common cutaneous malignancies and non-muscle skin cancers. In between 400,000 to a million cases are seen, and again, we don't have, it's not reportable, so we don't have very good numbers on their frequency. And when it comes to the factors playing a role in increased risk of squamous cell carcinomas, you see them up there, and these are pretty similar to what we went through in general for cutaneous carcinogenesis. The squamous cell carcinomas, the problem is that they do have a reasonable metastatic risk. It's not as high as for many other cancers that you may have heard or seen, but still, if you consider the sheer volume of squamous cell carcinomas, it causes a lot of human morbidity and also considerable mortality, especially if you consider that it is that the rate of metastasis is even higher, for example, in immunosuppressed individuals, and the immunosuppressed population is steadily rising because of new tools that we use for sort of immunosuppressing patients, and new tools for treating patients who have organ failure and our better ability to transplant patients and to allow transplant patients to survive. Not all squamous cell carcinomas are created equal. Some of them have much higher risk of metastasis than other squamous cell carcinomas. The risk associated with, or the factors associated with higher metastatic risks are depicted up there. The most important variants I'll show you clinical photos of and I'll talk about are these. First, we'll review keratoacanthomas, then squamous cell carcinoma in situ, then invasive squames, and then marginal ulcers. Keratoacanthomas are a special subgroup that actually in the European literature are not even necessarily considered malignancies because they do have a chance for spontaneous resolution. The problem is that it's very hard to differentiate them histologically and just by clinical grounds from some of the well-differentiated squamous cell carcinomas, and it's extremely hard to know with absolute certainty whether a lesion has zero potential for metastasis or is still a small potential for metastasis. So actually, in North America, keratoacanthomas are treated as well-differentiated low-grade squamous cell carcinomas. They are usually found on the head and neck in sun-exposed sites. Often they are solitary, but often in people whom you see one lesion, in the near future you'll see similar keratoacanthomas arise. These are sort of often dome-shaped. Patients will frequently tell you that volcano-like lesions that will have a keratinaceous center with a sort of a red, elevated, occasionally dome-shaped surrounding firm tumor with underlying induration. And sometimes they are much larger, occasionally they are smaller. Management is again, in North America, pretty much the same as for any of the squamous cell carcinomas. Next, we'll talk about squamous cell carcinoma in situ. These are also called Bowen's disease. In some exposed sites, mostly found in the elderly. They are going to be more frequent in more sun-exposed areas of the skin. They will start de novo or from actinic keratosis laden areas. And there's a special subgroup of squamous cell in situ which will obviously have HPV involvement, which is called erythroplasia of Krayrot, and that's found on the male genitalia, but also squamous cell carcinoma obviously can be found due to HPV on the female genital organs as well. And those, when it comes to their risks and sort of treatment options, go kind of along with sort of treatment options and risk for, interestingly, head and neck squamous cell carcinomas and squamous situs. One more thing, that squamous cell carcinoma in situ is an interesting entity in a way that it by itself has no chance of metastasizing, but if you have an invasive squamous cell carcinoma arise in a long-standing squamous cell carcinoma in situ, that actually has an increased risk of metastasis compared to a de novo squamous situ that starts sort of in a previously uninvolved area without a squamous situ adjacent. These are a couple of clinical images, and the problem with squamous situs is that they can resemble really areas of dermatitis, and they at times are relatively hard to differentiate from relatively benign conditions. Usually you'll see these scaly, occasionally minimally eroded plaques on the skin. The important thing is that they'll be very stable and slowly growing, and they won't show signs of spontaneous resolution, obviously. Invasive squamous cell carcinomas also usually will come in the elderly and sun-exposed skin areas, the differential diagnosis includes actinic keratosis, occasionally basal cell carcinomas, and warts. These are some of the potential clinical presentations. Sometimes you'll see these dome-shaped or highly keratotic areas that will occasionally resemble also keratoacanthomas and these well-differentiated squamous cell carcinomas. Occasionally you may also see ulcers that won't heal, which will slowly extend on their own, and sometimes you'll see these eroded or ulcerated tumors or papules in sun-exposed areas of the skin. Sometimes there'll be a lot more and sort of a lot harder to recognize and a lot easier a lot easier to essentially misconstrue for precancerous areas or for warts, because occasionally they may only show thickening of the skin with minimal sort of scar-like textural change underneath. So sometimes they can also, as we briefly mentioned before, affect the nail unit and the fingers. And when they affect the lip, they'll mostly affect actually the lower lip. There's a special subtype which resembles sort of a horn-like structure called a cutaneous horn of squamous cell carcinomas, and these sometimes actually have underlying warts or underlying squamous situs. So just by looking at these areas, you really can't tell what's underneath. So these will usually be removed surgically or with a biopsy to establish the underlying histological features, and then to offer treatment according to the histology. Occasionally they are small, occasionally they can be strikingly large. The other variant that I wanted to talk about is the marginal ulcer, and really the important thing to again remember is that in areas of constant ulceration and constant healing, you will also see a greatly increased risk of cancer formation. And these are those cancers, and they have much higher metastatic rate, and these are really very some squamous cell carcinomas. And the problem also is that often as they'll come in areas of constant ulceration and problems in wound healing, they will be very late recognized because they'll be misunderstood and misdiagnosed initially as just unhealing ulcers or super infected areas of the ulcer. The treatment for cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma is depend on risk, location, and subtype. But importantly, if something is very low risk and essentially there's no chance of metastasis, like for some of the squamous situs, destructive treatment can be offered with, for example, active desiccation and curettage, or sometimes even freezing treatment like we do for precancerous lesions. Whereas for higher risk areas, excision, or for the highest risk areas, obviously most micrographic surgery or even a combination of surgery and radiation therapy will be offered. And also there's occasionally a combined treatment for the highest risk lesions, especially for example in the head and neck area, with both most micrographic surgery or wide surgical excision and afterwards radiation treatment to reduce the chance of local recurrence and local nodal metastasis. One other thing to remember is that, again, squamous cell carcinomas are highly immunogenic, and really immunosuppression plays an important role in their the body's inability to sort of tackle them and get rid of them early on, I should say. So it's not a an uncommon thing to, for example, diagnose someone with CLL, with chronic leukemia, or with other conditions that will make people prone for immunosuppression that were previously undiagnosed, just because of diagnosing them with multiple squamous cell carcinomas and then sort of us going after the potential for underlying immunosuppression in the patients. And this is also important to remember because obviously squamous cell carcinomas are also a cancer subtype that is amenable to immunotherapy and that can be targeted with immunotherapy, which we'll briefly again discuss when we talk about melanoma. And immunosuppression, again, is very important to also remember because of transplant patients. The transplant patient population is increasing. Currently, there are approximately 300,000 patients who have had a solid organ transplant and who are undergoing immunosuppression because of solid organ transplant in the United States. And their risk of cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma, again, increases 65 to 250-fold, which is a stunning number. So literally, in these patients, often the question is not whether, but when. And the question is not sort of how you treat a single lesion, but how you do field treatment and treat invasive disease and follow them up frequent enough so that you can actually stay on top of all the skin cancers that form. In the transplant patients, there's also an increased risk of basal cell carcinoma and also a slightly increased risk of melanoma. But again, melanoma, obviously, when it comes to immunotherapy, is probably the cancer subtype at the forefront of immunotherapy. Yet, remember that although it is, when it comes to a transplant patient, so iatrogenic immunosuppression, the rate of melanoma actually only slightly increases compared to squamous cell carcinoma. One thing to remember here is that probably this is due to the fact that squamous cell carcinoma is not as good at modifying the local immune response as a tumor, whereas melanoma is very well adapted to sort of toning down the local immune response. So the presence or absence of systemic immunosuppression is not as much of a driver because the melanoma is already capable of mitigating the effect of any potential immune response. Kaposi's sarcoma is one other cancer that obviously is greatly increased in immunosuppressed patients. And the reason why it's so important in transplant patients to pay attention to cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma, that actually after a significant amount of survival, squamous cell carcinoma becomes one of the leading causes of even mortality in transplant patients. And when it comes to the role of immunosuppression, it has been indirectly proven, and we very well know, for example, that level of immunosuppression plays a role. The type of immunosuppression that people receive also play a role without going at much depth into it. And when it comes to level of immunosuppression, different transplanted organs require different level of immunosuppression because of their different likelihood of rejection. And we see a clear correlation with increased need for immunosuppression, for example, in cardiac transplant patients and increased risk of squamous cell carcinoma formation. So management, obviously, of the transplant patients is very important, and we need to be usually very aggressive with management of cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma in these patients and risk, and oftentimes we may even need to use chemoprophylaxis, which is seldom used otherwise in other populations of patients. So sometimes we will use essentially capecitabine, which is, if you view it that way, essentially the pre-drug of 5-FU, which will be converted to 5-FU-uricil, and will do systemic treatment in order to reduce the chance of skin cancer formation or systemic retinoids in these patients. Next, we'll talk about basal cell carcinoma. Basal cell carcinoma is actually the most common cancer, human cancer, and it's also obviously the most common skin cancer. It's responsible for almost 3 million cases of cancer diagnosed in the United States annually. And usually it comes at sites of sort of intermittent sun exposure, but chronic sun exposure also has a role, so it's kind of in between squamous cell carcinoma and the superficial spreading melanoma subtype. Most of it will come, again, in highly sun exposed areas, not surprisingly, and these are the variants that we'll discuss. The good news about basal cells is that they very rarely metastasize, and usually it takes a basal cell carcinoma that's neglected for an extremely long time for it to actually have a chance of metastasis, and usually they will metastasize after often, you know, decades and sometimes even longer time of growth and complete disregard for the presence of malignancy. They resemble basal layer cells of the epidermis. There's still an ongoing debate whether they actually arise from inner follicular epidermis, so epidermis and basal layer in between the hair follicles, or from hair follicle basal layer epidermis. These are sort of the histological patterns And the important thing is that histologically, I'm not going to go through these, it's not that important, but histologically, there are multiple subtypes, and the different subtypes will have very different chance of local recurrence. And because of that, the treatment recommendations might be different based on histological subtypes. The most common variant is the nodular basal cell carcinoma variant, responsible for approximately 60% of the cases. And these are usually raised glassy, sort of pearly papules. These are sort of the images that will be present on most of the brochures that are handed to patients. To look for, and they look for basal cell carcinomas. They at times can be large and extend fairly deeply. Sometimes they can also be ulcerated, and they have this, they call it rodent ulcer appearance, or they have where you have this raw border and central ulcerated tumor with often frequent bleeding from the area. They can also be pigmented, as all other subtypes, by the way, can be pigmented, making the differentiation from pigment cell tumors somewhat harder, although most of the cases you'll have relatively striking differences in the type of pigmentation that you see between a melanoma and a basal cell skin cancer. These are, again, some of the nodular variant images, which are these pearly papules. And occasionally, you know, people will say that that has been there for years, and they think that that's just an intradermal nevus, which may occasionally even appear very similar to basal cell as skin cancers, but usually dermatoscopy and looking at the area under 10x magnification under polarized light will enable us to diagnose them very early on. And these are a couple of them that are either larger or ulcerated, and they can also come in highly sun-exposed areas of, for example, the eyelid. This is one of these sort of rodent ulcer variants with the rolled border and central ulceration. And occasionally they can obviously be larger, and they can destruct sort of underlying normal structures. And these are a couple of pigmented basal cell skin cancers here. Superficial basal cell is the second most common. Favors the trunk and the extremities. These are sort of pink erythematous macules and thin plaques or papules. And quite frequently, they are not slam dunk and that easy to differentiate from benign inflammatory conditions, especially at the stage when we like to catch them, because obviously you strive to catch them when they are only a couple of millimeters in diameter, and really the features may not be well developed. And therefore, knowing it's very important that patients know their own skin and be able to recall that something has been present for more than a month or two, because that gives you a very good clue that that's much less likely to be a benign resolving inflammatory lesion than potentially a small basal cell. These are a couple of the sort of more obvious superficial basal cell carcinomas with some evidence of subtle scaling and in some areas very minimal pigmentation in them. Occasionally they can be larger, and sometimes they really can resemble just areas of dermatitis, and patients will come in and, oh, I have had this rash, and only growing, doesn't really bother me for a long time, and then you take a closer look at it and you tell them that it's not a rash and we should actually start treating it. Again, one which is pigmented, and sometimes they can be strikingly red and pearly pink. Occasionally they are lighter and not as easy to spot from a distance on people's skin. The other subtype that I wanted to discuss is morpheiform basal cell. They are also called sclerosing or infiltrating. The problem with these is that they really resemble scars and very hard to occasionally tell apart from scars, especially if your patient is not a very good historian. And they really, when it comes to diagnosis, the diagnosis will often depend on histology to prove that these are indeed basal cells and not just scars. So you see this area here, and oftentimes, you know, people will have history of some kind of trauma, and I diagnosed that was a very large, to my eyes, slam dunk basal cell carcinoma on someone's forehead, who was absolutely certain that she had trauma to the area early in her childhood, and that's only a scar. So often, you know, people may have sort of different recollections of areas, and it's important to look at these also under magnification to be able to make the diagnosis. Sometimes they can also be eroded. And So the reason why we want to treat basal cells is not because of their risk of metastasis when they are small, but because if they are untreated, they'll eventually grow and they'll erode surrounding structures, and then treating them will become a much bigger mess and a much bigger problem than extremely early on during the disease course, because once they start destroying normal structures, then you need to do really significant surgery with removing also quite a bit of normal tissue around and rearranging normal tissues to be able to sort of give fairly appropriate and fairly good cosmesis at these sites of larger basal cell carcinomas. And again, some of the more gruesome images, but very long growth and long neglect can lead to humongous lesions, and these are the ones that have a reasonable risk of also metastasis. And I unfortunately had the chance of following a few people who have actually had metastatic basal cell, and really it's still a disease that people can unfortunately succumb to if it gets to that point. But again, metastatic risk is very low, averaging around 1 in 10,000. But again, as it's low and in different populations, it will be somewhat different. The rates that are provided in the literature are quite varied. And really, as we mentioned before, it's going to happen in long-standing lesions. Treatment of basals really depends, again, on kind of the same concept as in squamous cell carcinomas, the risk, the location, the subtype. Location matters because on the middle of someone's back, if you have to take an additional 2 millimeters of normal tissue, it's not that big of a deal, whereas obviously on the middle of the face, preserving normal tissue is even more important. And that's the reason why higher risks are defined by sizes that are different from different sites of the body, and obviously a smaller tumor may still be viewed as higher risk for recurrence and higher risk for damage sort of to normal surrounding skin in, for example, cosmetically sensitive areas of the central face. And the treatment can be done with destructive treatment, either desiccation, curettage, cryotherapy. We can do also excision. We can do Mohs micrographic surgery. And also radiation treatment that can give you fairly good cosmesis and relatively good rates of cure. The problem with radiation treatment is you really can't treat someone with radiation treatment who's younger because of the risk of secondary malignancies in the area. I mentioned Mohs micrographic surgery. Why is it important? The problem is that sometimes what you see on the surface of the skin is just the tip of the iceberg. So occasionally you can have patients who have very little scar-like areas that actually will require very large surgeries to clean and to clear the tumor. If you go in and you go in blind and you only take sort of recommended margins, you will clear this area in multiple surgical steps, leading to really much larger removed normal area, because if you close in between two surgical steps, then in order to close an area, you have to take a mallet, so you're taking normal tissue as well. So you're increasing the amount of normal tissue that will need to be taken around the whole surgical site in the next step of surgery. So this is why Dr. Frederick Mohs came up with the idea of Mohs micrographic surgery, which is a surgical technique that really, it's not as much what you do surgically. There are some subtle differences. It's how you process the tissue. So instead of processing the tissue with conventional pathology and bread loafing, they actually process the tissue right away after surgery with sort of cryosectioning. And instead of cutting up the tissue sort of as a loaf of bread, you kind of need to envision spreading out the loaf of bread with the crust outside, and you cut the whole crust, and you essentially visualize the complete crust, and you make sure that there's absolutely no area. So yeah, I try not to hit it again. There's no area where the crust sort of is missing, so to say, and where there's more tumor at the outside margin. And by doing this, this is the image of that. Obviously, we section these, we mark these to know where exactly any sort of spread beyond the margins is found. And if more needs to be taken, then you can go back and take more and essentially repeat the whole process, and therefore ensure that you remove very little normal tissue, that you completely remove the whole cancer. And obviously this can be tremendously helpful because it limits the amount of tissue removed, but ensures complete removal of the tissue and very low recurrence rates. Sometimes even most surgeries is something that you can't choose because of the size of the tumor. and sort of because of patient comorbidities and because of inability of a patient to tolerate, for example, a longer procedure or the needed revision of the area that plastic surgery would need to do afterwards. So this is when radiation treatment or systemic therapy will come to play. I briefly already talked about radiation treatment. When it comes to systemic therapy, really lately it's small molecule inhibitors that you'll consider in basal cell carcinoma. And when it comes to small molecular inhibitors, this is a large basal cell carcinoma. It's really the Hedgehog pathway signaling inhibitors that are important. When it comes to basal cells, even sporadic basal cells, so not in Gorlin-Gross patients. Gorlin-Gross is obviously due to mutation in PADGE. So even patients who don't have a germline mutation in the pathway, the chance of PADGE mutation in their basal cells is going to be 60 to 70%. And therefore, these tumors can be targeted by inhibiting the Hedgehog signaling pathway. And there are multiple drugs that are available. They work very well. The problem is that, and I'll skip this, there are a lot of side effects. These are common really because of inhibition of the pathway. So all drugs that target the pathway will have very similar side effects. And because of that, the patient population that would require the treatment is usually, unfortunately, frail enough that they can't really tolerate the side effects of treatment. And therefore, oftentimes, they'll fail treatment and they'll still need to undergo surgery. There are a couple of trials trying to combine Hedgehog pathway inhibition with radiation treatment and other modalities to increase cure rates with potentially shorter duration treatment so that patients won't fail treatment because of side effects. This is a gentleman who actually received one of the Hedgehog pathway inhibitors and showed a very, very good improvement. The problem is that at this point, actually, after 3 months, he, because of side effects, decided to come off of the therapy. And then surgery was done. Because of multiple foci of basal cell actually left behind, he had to have essentially the whole area still removed and then repaired by plastic surgery. So if you fail treatment early on, then you're still into a relatively large surgery. Next, let's go over to melanocytes and melanoma. Melanocytes reside in the basal layer of the epidermis. They are in touch with multiple keratinocytes, and their role is to produce melanin. And just sort of know what melanin is made from, and remember that there's eumelanin and pheomelanin. Pheomelanin sort of responsible for the red pigmentation, and pheomelanin is less capable of absorbing UV light. And is also going to lead to generation of more reactive oxygen species. Melanosomes are formed in melanocytes, in the Golgi apparatus. Sort of these are essentially late endosomal compartments. And interestingly, melanocytes are neural crest origin, and they have these dendrite-like projections that are in touch with keratinocytes. And via this, they'll literally feed keratinocytes with melanosomes. And then the melanosomes in the keratinocytes will protect keratinocyte nuclei, and obviously they'll also protect melanocytes from UV damage. The signaling for the production of melanin by melanocytes is driven by UV light. And one thing to highlight here is that it is driven by DNA damage. The whole signaling is driven by the cellular DNA damage response. So in order to tan, they're not talking obviously about spray tan, but in order to tan, you need to have DNA damage. So again, if someone says that I'm just getting a base tan, I'm not burning myself, I'm not damaging my skin, not true. If you're tanning, you're damaging your skin. There's no way to tan with UV light and not damage your skin. And so obviously melanocytes are responsible for also producing the skin types. And interestingly, the important thing to remember is the type of pigment that determines the skin type and the type of melanosome produced and the amount of melanosomes produced and not the number of melanocytes. When it comes to abnormalities of pigmentation, so you can find sort of these benign groups of melanocytes that will be present in increased numbers that will cause sort of lentigo simplex or solar lentigenes on the skin. They can also produce benign melanocytic nevi on the skin. But obviously mutations and accumulation of additional mutations can lead to also melanoma formation. One thing that I'll highlight here and will repeat later on also, most of the melanomas start de novo. So most of the melanomas will not derive from atypical nevi. Many patients will come in from outside dermatologists to see us and will tell us that, well, I had a lot of precancers removed, and they'll tell us that, oh, they had atypical nevi removed. Atypical nevi are really not precancerous lesions for melanomas. They are extremely significantly atypical. And most of them are really just sort of variants of benign moles that have some features of atypia, which will have an extremely low chance of transitioning into an actual melanoma. An atypical nevus is suggested to have a risk of a 1 in approximately 30 to 40,000 of transitioning into melanoma, so that's the reason why we don't consider it precancerous, whereas a benign mole has a 1 in 250,000 chance of transitioning into melanoma. Most melanomas actually start brand new as a brand new black-brown area on the skin. And this is why, for people, knowing their skin is extremely important. And regarding the pathogenesis of melanoma, there's still a lot that we don't understand. When you look at many of the oncogenes and driver mutations that are responsible for melanoma that we know at this point, many of them will be found in benign moles, and many of them actually are found more frequently in benign nevi than in melanomas. So, again, there's still a lot to uncover if anyone is working on melanoma. This was sort of the original pathway and the original sort of scheme that was described for how melanoma is formed, but again, we think that there's a lot more to this than this figure. Important from the clinical point of view when it comes to melanoma is that there has been a striking rise of the incidence of melanoma. In the past 30 years, there has been an almost tripling of the incidence of melanoma. Interestingly, the melanoma mortality has remained pretty much stable. So that's an interesting thing that actually we're looking at this point in a small epidemiological study where we're trying to see whether sort of the recent economic crisis affected melanoma incidence and later on melanoma mortality to see whether we're actually catching disease that would later lead to mortality in people. This year we will see an estimated 91,000 cases of invasive melanoma, and we will have more than 9,000 people succumb to the disease. When it comes to melanoma incidence increase, and remember the incidence increase, that's what's highlighted here, but also remember the fact that really the whole incidence increase is due to the incidence increase in Caucasians. When it comes to darker skin types, we really don't see that incidence increase. And there's also a difference in the type of melanomas that we see in darker skin types, which I'll briefly talk about during the remainder of the talk and during the next slides. So again, melanoma has tripled in the last 30 years, but it's only incidence and not mortality, luckily. The lifetime risk is currently in between 1 in 35 to 75, and the median age of diagnosis is relatively young, and it's also important to remember that in young women, it's unfortunately the most common cancer that's diagnosed today. And there's some evidence that we have tanning partly to blame for that, and tanning booth use partly to blame for that. When it comes to the melanoma subtypes, these are the most important subtypes that I'll quickly go through. Superficial spreading melanoma is the most commonly seen subtype, approximately 70% of the cases between the ages of 30 and 50 can arise de novo or in pre-existing nevi also. But again, most of the cases will arise de novo. When it comes to the areas of presentation, again, mostly intermittently sun-exposed sites. So not the areas where you'll get most chronic damage, but the areas where you'll have bad burns at times, and then at times no follow-up UV radiation. And there's clear evidence that when it comes to the superficial spreading melanoma subtype, it's really bad early life sunburns that make people most prone to them. So we will still tell people to try to avoid sun exposure as much as possible, but much of the risk could already be there because of the early life sunburns. And usually this superficial spreading melanoma will have a very long sort of lateral spread, and the superficial spread a time during which we have a chance of obviously catching it. And the important thing about it is that because of this extremely long lateral spread, there's and late a vertical growth. Usually these are caught fairly early when they are thin, and as Breslow thickness is an important determinant of prognosis in melanoma, really many of the patients luckily will do fairly well with them if these are caught early. These are some of the images of sort of how it progresses along, and you see the area of vertical growth on the last image. And these are a couple of additional clinical images. You'll see these usually variably colored asymmetric areas of the skin with some dark pigmentation, although there can also be obviously amyotic melanomas, but usually with these darkly pigmented areas, also with border irregularity, and usually the diameter is going to be larger than the eraser on the end of the pencil, or 6 millimeters. But again, we do catch smaller melanomas as well, so it's not a given that all the melanomas will be larger, and they'll show evolution and change. So you'll see that in a pigmented lesion. And what I also highlight for patients to look for is really to look for something that really stands out of the crowd. Usually when people will have melanomas, many people will also have greatly increased number of benign nevi or atypical nevi. And often sort of on that sea of pigmented lesions, it's going to be very hard to differentiate problem spots from non-problem spots. And really looking for something that looks very different from everything else on the skin is much easier than looking for sometimes subtle changes or some of these features, because you don't need all these features for something to be of concern. And really that's something that's often helpful for patients. Nodular melanoma. This is the second most common subtype. Usually will present in the sixth decade of life with essentially no radial growth and just rapid deep growth, which leads to usually these being diagnosed later when they are thicker, and therefore there's going to be more advanced disease when it gets diagnosed. And these are more commonly seen as actually sort of chronically UV exposed areas of the skin. Of the upper trunk, mostly head and neck areas, actually. These are some of the clinical images where you'll often also see pigment, and you'll see these small nodules, which sometimes can be ulcerated and sometimes will have normal epidermal coverage. Ulceration is also a poor prognostic feature, and that's actually also one of the projects that we're interested in. We're trying to look for earlier features that suggest that a lesion will be prone to ulceration that would signal higher risk of melanoma. And we're working on that with a group from Newcastle. These are, again, a couple of clinical images. Sometimes the pigmentation is not that obvious. Occasionally, they can even look blue, and sometimes they may, from a distance, look very, very much just pink. Acral lentiginous melanoma is another subtype. It's less common, but this is a very important subtype in darker skin types. These actually will come in areas of the skin that are more prone to trauma, and often even on the soles and of the feet and the palms of the hands will come in more trauma-prone areas. There was a study that came actually out of Korea where they showed very nicely on a roughly high number of acral lentiginous melanoma patients that really they will follow even patterns of trauma at times. So really this is just to say that not all melanomas are driven only by sun exposure. Because of the location, usually these are actually diagnosed later, and therefore the prognosis will be worse. A couple of images. And next we'll talk about lentigomalignant melanoma. This is kind of an opposite to, in a way, to acral lentiginous melanoma. This usually comes in highly sun-exposed areas of the skin. Usually these are diagnosed relatively earlier because these are going to be also cosmetically visible sites where there's going to be slow growth in a pigmented lesion that will be usually variably colored. Here the problem is actually that usually growth is so small that patients, unless they are stressed and stressed to bring in photos or to compare, will tell you that, oh, there has been no change. And it looked the same a month ago as it does right now. But if you look at a photo 5 years prior, then you will see that there has been considerable change in these areas. Usually there's a very long sort of lateral growth before there's an invasive component that arises in these tumors, but invasive component eventually may arise and may lead to even deadly disease. That said, one of the headaches that these lesions and these tumors cause to us is how to treat them, because often they'll present in elderly patients who who are not very good surgical candidates, often in highly cosmetically sensitive sites that are hard to later on cover with plastic surgical procedures. And really, you will need to decide on how aggressive you want to be with something that has a relatively low chance of harboring underlying invasive components. So actually, one of the studies that Wendy Haas currently is spearheading, which I'm also involved in, is looking at markers of what we could look for in the epidermal compartment that we could easily look at with, for example, tape stripping, which is a non-invasive method of isolating epidermal cells that contain also DNA, and sort of look for features and look for genomic profiles that can tell you that there's a much greater likelihood of invasive component being underneath requiring surgical treatment, or that there's a lower likelihood, and then we can do local immunotherapy or we can do disruptive treatment for these lesions with much lower chance of long-term adverse patient outcomes. This is lenticular malignant melanoma with a nodular area, and there with vertical growth. Melanoma management, it's important to do a generous biopsy to be able to evaluate the whole tumor, because really the structure of the cancer tells a lot. So in an early melanoma, sometimes differentiating from a very atypical melanocytic nevus may be hard, and if you have a partial biopsy, it can become almost impossible. So usually we'll remove the whole lesion in total to allow pathologists to section through and to look at the whole area. And treatment relies on wide excision for the thinner tumors. A really wide excision is sufficient. A variant of Mohs surgery can be done. Mohs surgery directly cannot be done in the form that it is done for squamous cell carcinoma or for basal cell carcinoma, because really melanocytes cannot be very, very well imaged on frozen sections. So you really can't rely on frozen sections. You actually have to embed the tissue and then cut the tissue, and best is to actually stain the tissue also with some kind of melanocytic marker like MITF or SOX-TAN. And then after you stain it, you can very well evaluate for features of presence of disease laterally. And so what we do in these cancers often, especially in highly cosmetically sensitive areas, is that we do staged excisions or slow Mohs procedures, where you will be cutting out the cancer with 5 millimeter margin, and then you will leave the whole area open. You'll have the patient come back the next day, and then you will take more only in the area where you see lateral spread of the cancer beyond your margins. And this way you can reach full control of the margins without removing too much normal skin. And especially if you decide to do surgery for lenticular malignant, or you do surgery for obviously lenticular malignant melanoma, this becomes an important factor, because sometimes you can have lateral spread of the tumor in a non-pigmented manner around the pigmented tumor. So sometimes actually you can't really see atypical melanocytes even with the naked eye, or occasionally even with dermatoscope or Wood's light, which can sometimes highlight them. The reason why melanoma is really such a concern, and I'll go through this very quickly, is because really this is probably the cancer where you can see the smallest disease that can still lead to potentially a demise of the patient. Really, you don't need anything more than in volume, the volume of a single piece of rice. And a patient potentially years later, or even occasionally months later, can succumb to melanoma. When it comes to evaluating melanoma and the risk of melanoma for giving you adverse disease outcomes and spreading to lymph nodes and then spreading also later on to distant metastatic sites, the feature that's mostly correlated with long-term outcome is Breslow depth. So the thickness of the tumor measured from the granular cell layer. It is even better correlated than the initially sort of published Clark levels, which correlated with sort of layers of invasion of the tumor into various different compartments of the skin. And so really it is as there's a striking correlation, and this is why catching melanoma early is so important. Early in the disease, besides thickness, ulceration is also a very important prognostic feature, and that's also used for staging the tumor. And when it comes to the different stage groups, really this is how you see that thicker tumors with ulceration. These are actually all tumors that obviously have no evidence of central lymph node involvement or any distant metastatic disease will show a marked increase in melanoma mortality long-term than thinner tumors without evidence of of ulceration. Otherwise, obviously, if the disease spreads beyond the initial tumor compartment, then central lymph node status is very important in determining long-term prognosis, and that's used for staging the disease in stage 3 disease. And there are also some local regional other spread features that can be taken into account. If anyone is interested, you can look through this in the slides, but it's not a must. I left it in sort of to be able to use as a go-to information sheet of most important things on skin cancers, but you don't have to memorize it, obviously, go through every single detail in there. And in stage 3 disease, it's really a combination of both the local regional spread and also the local tumor features that will define on how someone does. And thick disease with local regional spread and significant involvement of nodes will lead to very poor outcomes, whereas even if there is lymph node involvement in a very thin lesion, you can actually have very good outcomes and 90% or so survival rates, long-term survival rates. Obviously, when the disease spreads beyond the local regional compartment, there's going to be a very poor outcome, and especially the disease that affects the central nervous system. And there are multiple other prognostic factors that are obviously important in prognosticating melanoma, and the problem is we don't have really good tools at this point, so this is actually also an important aspect of cutaneous oncology research. They have tried to create quite a few sort of molecular markers of mRNA signatures, but there's currently only one that's used in the clinic, and even this has many of us sort of doubting its use and efficacy. Again, just to go through it quickly and just to repeat that currently there's still a lot that we don't know about melanoma and how the disease comes about, how sort of some cells will escape oncogenic senescence and will acquire additional mutations and will lead to the formation of tumors, and how then the melanoma cells escape the tumor compartment. But we do know that many other mutations than the initially recognized sort of driver mutations are important in melanoma. When it comes to melanoma therapy, really, melanoma therapy has been completely revolutionized in the past decade. A decade ago, there were a couple of chemotherapy options which had dismal survival benefit at horrendous complications for patients, and really there wasn't a lot that could be offered for patients. And then first small molecular inhibitors came along, and then later obviously also immunotherapy. When it comes to small molecular inhibitors, obviously you probably all heard of BRAF, V600E, and other BRAF, V600 mutations that are driver mutations in melanomas. And again, one thing to remember, yes, they are driver mutations in melanomas, but they are actually more frequently found in nevi than in melanomas. Nevertheless, targeting them can lead to very fast reduction in melanoma burden, and these are used clinically. From one of the original papers, the PET-CT disease reduction achieved within only 2 weeks of initiating treatment. And because of the fast efficacy of small molecular inhibitors, obviously there's a lot of interest in developing new and other small molecular inhibitors, and obviously also because once you use a small molecular inhibitor in melanoma, as in other cancer subtypes, if you use it long enough, eventually a clone will emerge that will be able to circumvent the inhibition and will give rise to additional potentially metastatic foci, and the disease will overcome treatment. And therefore also there are studies that target sort of any pathways that can circumvent the BRAF inhibition to essentially preemptively target those as well. And currently, actually, usually we won't give BRAF inhibitors in single treatment. It's going to be a combination of MAC inhibition and BRAF inhibition for the treatment of metastatic melanoma, because that will actually not only have a much better profile and response, but also will limit other cutaneous side effects, because if you solely inhibit BRAF, then you actually will see an increased risk of cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma in those patients, which is again a longer story. But if you actually also include MEK inhibitors, then you will not see that that fairly high and rapid rise of squamous cell carcinoma risk. Obviously, the other transformational treatment is immunotherapy, and mainly checkpoint inhibitors currently that are used in melanoma treatment that have completely revolutionized the treatment of melanoma. Again, I'm pretty sure that you all heard a lot about checkpoint inhibitors. The only thing to remember is that really melanoma is kind of the quintessential tumor where they were initially tried and they are used. And melanoma is in a way a great tumor to use them because of the location of the tumor and because of the very high mutation burden and UV mutation burden, because that results in a high neoantigen production, and therefore the tumors are thought to be very immunogenic. And that's also probably one of the reasons why they are also initially, and then they evolve very good at avoiding the sort of endogenous immune response, and by interfering with their ability to avoid the endogenous immune response is so profoundly beneficial for the patients. Obviously, no one thinks that single immune checkpoint inhibition will solve melanoma as a problem, and there's considerable interest in combining checkpoint inhibition with intralesional therapy, with oncolytic viruses, with potentially also other immune modifiers. And I don't know how much of you heard about, for example, IDO inhibitors and the recent failure of the trial, for example, where they failed to show sufficient benefit in combination of IDO inhibitor and with pembrolizumab. So currently sort of what's done in oncology is that people usually will be tried on the double agent small molecule inhibitor treatment, especially if they have fast-growing tumor, or single agent immunotherapy initially. And in case they fail treatment, then the other arm may be available for them, or they could they enroll into various different studies that do combination treatments, or which will do intralesional treatments with, for example, systemic immunotherapy. And really long term, the hope is that that plateau that people are reaching with immunotherapy will be able to raise, and will have a much higher proportion of patients showing long term survival after sort of being diagnosed with metastatic melanoma. But really, there's already that patient population. So we already have patients coming to our clinic whom we are, and I know it will sound probably unusual, but kind of happy to be able to diagnose with their second and third melanomas, because that means that they are surviving after a widely metastatic melanoma that they were diagnosed some years ago. Actually, one thing that we're seeing, and that's important, that may be important almost regardless of what field you're in, if you're looking at immunotherapy, that immunotherapy for the metastatic cancer that may work may not actually work for early phases of that very same tumor, or early phases of similar cancers evolving in patients. I've seen multiple patients in the clinic who have had early melanomas diagnosed, who actually had complete response previously to metastatic melanoma, and are at this point disease-free from metastatic melanoma, yet we still diagnose them with early invasive melanoma or in situ melanoma, showing that really we weren't able to eliminate early disease by doing the immunotherapy for the widely metastatic disease. So just very quickly to go through this, because it's important to remember sort of as scientists and as people who may get questions about also skin cancer from peers who don't know as much about cancer and science, that when it comes to skin cancer, really our goal should be prevention. And as I mentioned before, tanning equals damage. So there's no tanning without damage. So if someone can prevent tanning, obviously that's ideal. That said, obviously, when it comes to melanoma risk, especially the most frequently seen superficial spreading melanoma, it's really bad early life sunburns that matter most. So really avoiding sunburns is still very important as well. But we can't emphasize the importance of avoiding also tanning. And really this is what people should be doing. So try to avoid burning. avoid tanning in general, seeking the shade, especially during the peak UV index hours, and then using broad spectrum sunscreens, which protect also against UVB and UVA light, and also cover up as much as possible. And as I told you before, sometimes when it comes to prevention, the message that if you don't prevent sun damage, you won't reduce skin cancer risk, and you'll have increased skin cancer risk, may not be something that especially younger people will buy. So then you can switch to the other message, which is cosmesis. But really, it has been it's absolutely obvious that really UVA is one of the most important determinants of skin aging. You see that photo from New England Journal of Medicine published a few years ago of that gentleman who drove a truck for 25 years, and because of driving a truck, on the left side of the face was exposed to a lot more UVA coming through the window, and he had very uneven photo damage to his skin and wrinkling on his skin because of the UVA damage. And it also causes, besides wrinkles, skin discoloration, various lentigines and other blemishes. And when it comes to secondary prevention, self-skin checks are tremendously important to catch problem spots, especially to diagnose them as early as possible. And when it comes to all skin cancers, really early diagnosis makes them very easily treatable conditions, whereas late diagnosis definitely creates problems. And when it comes to concerning features of what to look for in pigmented lesions, again, just to highlight, this is something I've been through but not listed like this before, look for asymmetry, border irregularity, color variegation or variation, increased diameter, evolution, and look for something that stands out of the crowd, something that's funny or funky that's not up there because it kind of, it would look kind of foolish, but it's actually, it works very well for patients and for anyone if people look for something that stands out of the crowd and looks very unusual. And then it comes to non-mammal skin cancers, look for growing pink papules, look for sores that do not heal, or areas that bleed very easily and repeatedly with very minimal frequent trauma. For example, sites that will bleed with shaving, various other sites don't show bleeding and it's always the same site, that potentially could also be a sign of an early skin cancer in an area. Or spontaneously appearing growing scars. And early diagnosis is key, and obviously if anyone notices problem spots and reporting them to dermatology to be able to evaluate them is important, because there are a lot of mimickers of skin cancers that can be benign, that can look very much alike. So these are the things that we've been through. I know I had a lot of things that I tried to cover. Feel free to ask questions. Thank you for the attention. And again, focus on the slides where you had the exclamation marks, and no one is expecting you to study through the whole packet that you received. Any questions, you can also write an email. It's also included in the packet. And also, obviously, feel free to ask questions now. Lip?
Yeah.
Yes, interestingly, even tongue might be. So the interesting thing is that, for example, in ST patients,